Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is an examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the inescapable, indelible, and indispensable influence of drugs on society. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being drug users. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when drug users are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized.
You know, I've always kind of said that, like, beer is a wonderful object in itself, but that's not necessarily why I look at it as a scholar, you know. We have this tendency to pay attention to the big things, right? Like the big events, the headliners, and we do need to pay attention to those things because they shape the world we live in. But I don't know that they're any more important than the ubiquitous things, the little things, like coffee and beer and weed and the things that you're going to be talking about on your show, right? Like, these things affect every aspect of American life, from legislation to, you know, income and spending to cultural meanings and childhood development. And, you know, it's okay, I would say. It's okay to take beer seriously. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, it's just fun. Why do you need to do that? But, like, why not, right? You're going to spend however many hours of your life on a stool in a bar somewhere, you might as well think about it.
That's J. Nicole Beckham. She's a cultural studies and communications professor at Randolph College and the author of Value of a Pint, a book on beer culture in America that's due out next year from University of Nebraska Press. More from her in a minute. Free Culture Radio is about drug culture. The theme for this edition is beer. Alcohol, after all, is a drug. That's a thing that our society really needs to get clear if we're going to have a rational, honest discussion about drug use and drug policies. Whether you use alcohol or not, you have to admit, beer has had a tremendous impact on American society. So, on this edition of Free Culture Radio, we're going to talk about beer. We're going to talk about craft beer and the unbearable whiteness of brewing. We'll ask why Portlanders are so drawn to beer. But first, we're going to learn how to brew the stuff.
Jason Webb, and it's Portland U Brew and Pub, and also Unicorn Brewing Company, where we brew just custom brews. It starts with making a recipe, just like a chef has a recipe. And it's four ingredients, sometimes five. It's water, barley, hops, and yeast. And you formulate a recipe by starting with barley, and then you got hops and yeast on a recipe, and the water. And so every beer, say you're making one keg of beer, for example, like a half a barrel, 15 and a half gallon keg, it'd be 21 pounds of what's called a base grain, because there's starches readily available, converted to sugar starches in the base grain, 21 pounds. And then to give you color, maybe if you're making a stout, use blackened barley or caramelized barley. They're called specialty grains. And what they do, they kind of tumble and roast them, kind of like coffee in a way, and they caramelize it. They caramelize these at different color levels. It's called Levibon. And that will make up just the color and flavor, just the beer part. And then the hops, there's over 50 strains of hops, and they all have different flavors also, just like the barley. And you get to pick and choose those because you get different flavors and aromas from all those different hops. And then, on top of that, you got yeast. There's all kinds of different yeast strains. So the water that you use, the barley, the base barley, the specialty grains of the barley, the hops and yeast all create unique flavors in a recipe. So that's what you start with. Then you have equipment. You have what's called a mash tun or lauter tun. Those guys there. And there's a screen on the bottom. It's called a false bottom. And it's got little slots in it, so after you run the barley through a barley mill, because you want to crack open the kernels of the barley, expose the starch and the specialty grains, the screen holds that crushed or milled barley. And what you do is you do something called mash in. You pour in 30 to 40 pounds of barley into the mash tun and with hot water inside it. And that's called strike water. The strike water is typically 160 to 170 degrees. And after you pour in 30 to 40 pounds of milled barley into that hot water, you lose about 8 to 12 degrees. You go for what's called a mash strike temperature, and it's a goal between 150 and 160, that window there. Under, I think, 146, it's not warm enough because you're trying to wake up the beta and amylase, the enzymes, the natural enzymes in the barley. You're waking them up, and they're converting those long chains of starches into sugars, but different types of sugars by mash temperature. 155 is in the middle. You're starting to create unfermentable sugars. And what that does is affects the body of the beer at the end of fermentation because it's called attenuation. If you create complex sugars with different temperatures, higher mash temperatures, you leave, the yeast has a hard time fermenting it all the way out, and it adds body and maltiness. If you want a real dry, crisp beer, you create simple sugars at lower mash temperatures, say 148, 150. So what you're doing that, it takes about 45 minutes. There's pumps on mash tuns, and we pump what's called wort. Sweet wort is the liquid barley sugar that you created from the mash. So if you pump for 10 minutes on top of the mash on itself with these hoses here, the wort trickles through the husks of the barley, and it creates a natural filtration and adds clarification because you don't want powders and chunks. Because what's going to happen after that is we pump the sweet clear wort now into the kettle, the steam jacketed kettle. And then, so the mash is all the sweet wort's getting pumped out of the mash into the kettle. You have to do something called sparging. Sparging is where you rinse all that sugar out of the mash with about 170 degree water, and that strips or rinses all the sugar out of the mash, and you get in the kettle. That takes a little over 30 minutes. Close the lid up, and you gotta wait till 212 degrees Fahrenheit, which is boil. It takes about 45 minutes after you get the kettle full. And then what we do is we boil the sugar for 60 to 90 minutes. The biggest reason is the bacteria. You want to boil off the bacteria. But you're also able to add hops throughout that boil in different additions of the 60 to 90 minute boil. When you add hops in different additions, you get different effects from that hop. If you boil one hop at 60 minutes, the beginning of the boil, the whole 60, that's called a bittering addition. When you add hops 45 minutes remaining, or maybe 30 minutes remaining in the boil, that's called a flavor addition. And because when you add hops at the end of the boil, it's called noble or aroma hopping, you just get an aroma effect. But then, if you're making an IPA, there's something called dry hopping. And that's later when you add even more hops into fermentation. It's just like a steeping tea or an aroma bomb. So, we boil for 60, 90 minutes, kill all the bacteria, kind of caramelize the wort, condense it a little bit, add hops throughout the boil. And then we run it through this plate-looking thing. It's called a heat exchanger. And it chills it from 212 boiling down to 70 instantly. I mean, it flash chills it. And that's that way we could tri-clamp it or pump it into our sanitized fermenters. Then we add yeast, if the temperature's right. Ales ferment between 60 and 90 Fahrenheit, and lagers ferment between 40 and 60, around there. So if the temperature's right, we add yeast. And yeast is a fungus, and it's going to wake up in its new sugar environment 5-12 hours later, and it's going to start eating the sugars and fermenting. It creates carbon dioxide gas, CO2, and alcohol, and it creates heat. You have to control the temperature of fermentation. Otherwise, each yeast strain has a certain temperature range that you want to ferment it at. If you go too warm, if you let it ferment too warm, one, you can let it, it'll die, or two, it's going to give off nasty phenolics and esters that you don't want. They don't taste good. So controlling the temperature is crucial. Checking your sugar level with a hydrometer. And so it's pretty much 7 to 10 days, primary fermentation it's called, and it's moving along. Big foamy head on top, it's called a Krausen, it's a yeast colony, it's going down, fermenting. Check the gravity with what's called a Zwickel port here. And if it's where, according to the recipe, you got original and final gravity, when it's ready, you cold crash it.
You said check it with the Zwickle.
Yes.
So that's where Zwickle, whatever the Zwickle, Zwickle right, that's the Zwickle Fest.
Zwickle Fest is, yeah, where people, we do it every year. People come in and you get to take samples right out of the tank.
That's Zwickle Fest.
Warm and raw, uncarbonated.
Yep.
I see the posters. I never understood what it was about.
That's what it means. Yeah, so primary fermentation, 7-10 days. Cold crash it with a product called propylene glycol. It's a food grade refrigerant.
Yeah.
And it runs through these insulated jackets in and out. Now, the reason why they're coned like that is because when yeast gets cold, it drops. And that way we can collect the yeast and actually harvest from the bottom and pitch into future batches. And then, yeah. Then you, some breweries do different types of carbonation. You could, some breweries have a big tank, it's called a bright beer tank, where they'll force carb with a big long stainless steel rod inside. Or what we do, these are 1.5 barrel conicals. We get 3 half barrel, 3 full-size kegs. And the beer is cold and flat. And then we do something called force carbonation, where we'll throw PSI, pounds per square inch of CO2 gas on the keg for a couple days. And then it's ready to serve.
Wow.
So yeah,
And that's it. That's
Well, that's not it. There's quite a lot to it. I've been in the industry for 24 years and 8 breweries. I'm still learning things a lot. So, there's always something, and it's all about experimenting, creating new recipes, and just having fun.
That was Jason Webb with Portland U-Brew and Unicorn Brewing Company. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. J. Nicole Beckham, Ph.D., is a communications and cultural studies professor at Randolph College in Lynchburg, Virginia. Professor Beckham studies and writes about, among other things, beer and beer culture. Tell me something about yourself.
I guess in relation to beer, I'm a passionate fan. I make beer. I drink beer. For a while, I judged beer. So it really is kind of a leisure pursuit insofar as I would do it even if it weren't my object of study. But it's one of those things where you spend enough time being passionate about something, you do, right, like see things that flummox you or trouble you or frustrate you or interest you. And that definitely happened with me and my experience of beer, and particularly craft beer culture in the United States. It just raised so many questions that I was like, you know what? There's something going on here and I need to look more closely.
And when you say you've judged, I was looking at your CV. You're certified as a professional judge. What? I'm not. I should know that, but I really don't. How do you become certified?
Actually, anybody can do it. There's an organization called the Beer Judge Certification Program, the BJCP. They are one of the organizing bodies that is responsible for defining what are kind of sanctioned beer styles in the United States. So you essentially have to go through a kind of an examination process. There's a paper exam that you need to pass that is not terribly easy to be provisionally sanctioned as a BJCP judge. And then there is actually like a field test, a tasting test that you need to do. And then in order to stay active, you need to judge or steward, act as a steward for a certain number of sanctioned competitions every year. There's a point system, essentially. It's kind of like a continuing education system.
So it's more than just being a regular at a pub. You actually do. There is some paperwork involved.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it's a lot of fun.
To what extent would you say that American culture, the mainstream dominant American culture, has been shaped by beer?
I would say that it's difficult to overstate how tightly woven beer. The politics around beer, the way we value beer, the way we understand beer, the way we put it to work in our everyday lives has shaped the complexion of American culture. And that, honestly, that question, how deeply, to what extent and to what ends kind of drives the work that I do.
Indeed. I was reading your dissertation. It's quite good. How did you put it? Beer is inextricably a part of American everyday life, and as an object of study, it provides an intriguing point of entry to the everydayness of economic practices that has in many ways eluded contemporary discussions of American economics. How did it all start? I mean, is it from the English and the Germans? How did America get so hooked on beer?
There's a couple kind of ways to answer this question, but I think the easiest and perhaps the kind of, I guess, easiest to follow is, you know, because Europe was hooked on beer, and we kind of imported it with European settlement. That's not to say that there weren't other kind of spontaneously fermented beer-like beverages to be found on the North American continent before European settlement, but the tradition that kind of defines American culture is largely European. But it's a different kind of contextual drinking than we do now. You have to understand that at the time, probably the beer that was most ubiquitous in households was on average a lower alcohol. It was to some degree an issue of public health, particularly in Europe in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. Where you started to get very large settlements of people with a poor understanding of sanitation practices, water wasn't always the safest thing to drink. Beer, however, particularly a low-alcohol beer, went through boiling, and so it was far more salubrious than lots of the waters that were available. It was often a part of the monastic tradition. So the church often made the beer for a settlement. And so it was, in a lot of ways, connected with, you know, the moral authority of a particular area. The word pub comes from public house, and that usually was attached to your church. So, you know, it came over with European settlement, and very quickly, you know, establishing a beer making tradition in the United States was, you know, part of establishing American settlements. I think if you look at something like sales, beer, or just by volume production, beer does dominate other alcoholic beverages, but it's hard to say whether it dominates culturally in the way it would somewhere like Germany, right? We drink a lot of it, but it is largely still a very mass-produced product here that perhaps doesn't have some of the cultural resonance that it might in other places. But you can't argue against the volume of it we drink. We drink beer in volumes that have traditionally rivaled coffee and milk. So.
Alcohol in American culture, it would be tough to disentangle, but there are the subcultures.
Yeah.
I mean, I live in Portland, Oregon. We have water that's comes out of the tap fairly, you know, very tasty and drinkable. A few problems with lead, but we're in the middle of a hop growing region.
Mm-hmm.
So and Portland is one of the demographically one of the whitest cities in the United States. So is that why Portland is one of the centers of microbrew?
Gosh, that's a good question. And hard to answer. I'm not sure whether the relationship is like just coincident, as in that the kind of demography of craft beer culture and Portland just sort of match up, and so it was kind of a match made in heaven and flourished, or whether there was any sort of kind of causality going on. I mean, I think Portland it's simply well positioned to be a good craft beer town, given, given its location in a major hop growing region. It's already, I mean, you mentioned coffee, but that really is a kind of aesthetic discernment, right? Like, you've kind of got a consumer base there who's used to caring about comestibles, whether it's food or coffee, in a way that, you know, a lot of people who just like will throw some, you know, instant in a cup won't. You know, that's already sanctioned and culturally appropriate in a place like in Portland. So it's just a very, I will say, I will use my favorite adjective as a beer brewer. It's a very yeasty environment for something like craft beer.
Well, in fact, you've actually looked at things like the farmers market, the green economy, and such, and how does that interrelate with the craft beer movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really related. A chapter I published in a collection just called of Food in Everyday Life from Lexington Press. I wrote an article there about sustainable brewing because, for a number of reasons that are kind of complex to trace out, you know, craft brewers have been some of the most enthusiastic to kind of take up the rhetoric, but also some of the practices of sustainable business. You know, I think they have an ethos that points to the local already. They have a certain level of pride in small-scale production and responsible production. If you go to, you know, the Brewers Association and look at their definition of craft, there is a piece in there that craft brewers generally have a kind of altruism or relationship of respect to the communities in which they're embedded. And I think that whole kind of piece of the craft beer movement fits together really well with some of the things that are going on with our green economies and sustainability. But you know, I think both of them also, right, have unintended consequences or exclude certain folks with perhaps not meaning to. Both are things that are far more attainable for those with economic means and higher educational attainment. So there's a lot of parallels between the two things.
I want to get to one of your other journal articles that's in prep. Craft Brewing Black Beer and the Values of Subculture. Unpack that.
Okay. You know, so I mentioned when you asked me a little bit about my history in craft beer. I think, to be 100% honest, one of my most significant, or I don't know, you might want to call it formative moments, was when I lived on the West Coast. I was living in San Diego, and I had, you know, been kind of a self-professed beer geek for several years. I had a job that required a ton of travel. And one of the things I noticed is that if you are traveling alone and eating alone, you can always sit at the bar and you don't look like a weirdo. This is one of those... Right? It's one of those like, magical cultural powers of alcohol. Like, it makes you not look like a crazy. So I drank a lot of local beers when I was traveling and, you know, I had a great time. And it was when I was in San Diego that I started kind of going to events produced by the San Diego Brewers Guild, going to beer festivals, going to tastings. It's when I learned to homebrew. You know, I wasn't really like looking for the difference, but it was very obviously that I was like, oh, one of these things is not like the other, you know. And for a good long time, I was not only one of the few women in the room, I was quite possibly or quite more of the time, often than not, the only woman of color in the room. And I think for a really, really long time, I was just kind of like, these people are awesome. This community is great. No need to think about these kind of things. But I think you can only go so long as a curious person who likes to pick things apart before you just start asking, like, why? Why am I the only one here? So that line of the work has kind of always been there. And that article you just referenced tries to dig into that a bit. And there are a couple of things. For me, that article is largely about the moment when beer decided to, or brewers, large macro brewers, decided to market malt liquor to predominantly Black communities. Lots of people will kind of dig into the ethics of that decision. You know, and you can go around in circles forever and ever, but it's hard to deny that it was a productive marketing decision, right? Whether it was an ethical one, that we can talk about that another day. But I think that relationship changes the relationship of Black America to beer for a long time, right? And it persisted through decades, through Billy Dee Williams and then all the kind of West Coast rappers sponsoring St. Ides, right? So you got this kind of conflation of a particular kind of urban Blackness and this product that is just freaking awful, right? Like, that stuff tastes horrible. And so I think what you saw kind of as a backlash, or perhaps as just a result, is that upwardly mobile Blacks really seemed to shun beer, right? They went to kind of premium liquors as a way to kind of do conspicuous upper mobility in drinking. You really just didn't see a lot of middle-class Black Americans wanting to drink beer. And I think there's just some residual effects of that, you know? I think some of it is just, you know, the homogeneity of the craft beer community. I think you have to kind of be a little bit more of an outward or assertive person to want to kind of hang out in a place where you, by virtue of being there, are kind of different. You know? So it's something I think about a lot. I mean, hopefully you can tell from my work and from the things I write, I have a long-lasting love affair with craft beer and the people who make it and the people who drink it. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I have to be critical about what's going on in that community, particularly because I want to see more people of all kinds there.
Is it evolving?
Yeah, I think it is. I think definitely for women, you know, like now I think women are, you know, we're still not anywhere approaching numbers of male craft beer drinkers, but women have, I think, a much more comfortable foothold, even as brewers. But I think diversification is, it's a slower process, right? It's a slower process. But I do think it's happening. The dissertation that you have kindly mentioned is going to be changed somewhat, but will be published from the University of Nebraska Press in my new book, which will be called The Value of a Pint. And then there's a colon with lots of other stuff after it. I'm not exactly certain when the book will come out, but keep an eye out for it. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. Folks who are interested in hearing about any of this stuff can just look at my website, jnicolebeckham.com. That's JNICOLBECKHAM.com. And same thing, J. Nicole Beckham is my Twitter handle. I tweet about beer and other random things. So if you want to get at me, get at me.
That's it for this edition of Free Culture Radio. I want to thank my guest, Professor J. Nicole Beckham from Randolph College, for talking to us about beer culture. Special thanks to Jason Webb of Portland U-Brew and Unicorn Brewing for teaching us about beer making. And my thanks to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. The show has a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/KBOO Free Culture Radio. Please give it a like. You have been listening to Free Culture Radio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. Only on KBOO Portland.
KBOO is gearing up to celebrate 50 years of community radio, and we need your help. Take the Big Events survey on KBOO.fm and help us decide what kind of events you would attend or help build. Go to KBOO.fm and click on the survey banner to help prepare for the Kaleidoscope of KBOO, Past, Present, and Future, 50th Anniversary Celebration.
Join KBOO Community Radio and Sean Stewart on Friday, December 30th from 8 p.m. to midnight as we end the year with a live music extravaganza, potluck, and ladies' jam. We will be featuring the avant-garde experimentalism of the Institute for Creative Dying, Brandon Conway of the Creative Music Guild, and the ladies' jam featuring Gabby Holt, Stephanie Selza, and many more. We will also be featuring guest DJ Kathleen Heisler and Rock and Roll by the Carotids. Come on down to KBOO Community Radio, located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, right off East Burnside, next to the Jupiter Hotel and the Dougsboro Lounge. Again, that's Friday, December 30th, from 8 p.m. to midnight. Don't forget to bring a snack to share and an instrument to jam on.
Hey there, KBOO listeners. It's now almost 7. It is now 7. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, KBOO.fm on the web. We have your Wednesday episode of Hard Knock Radio coming up right here next. Bear with me for a moment. Okay.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Portland.